Political Pulse is made possible by listeners and by Lee Auto Malls, offering new and used vehicles to help Mainers explore the beauty of their home state. Learn more at leeauto.com.
Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz with Maine Public's Chief Political Correspondent Steve Missler and Senior Political Correspondent Mal Leary. On this edition of The Pulse, we're going to take a look at the political media that's out there. And as a public service, we should say a lot of it, at least this week, is fabricated. One example, White House Social Media Director Dan Scavino shared a video on social media that made it look like Joe Biden fell asleep during an interview. The video was a composite of two interviews, one featuring actor Harry Belafonte, the other Biden, who was awake at the time. Republican Congressman Steve Scalise also shared a doctored video of Biden. And then there's a Facebook post circulated quoting Boston Celtic Larry Bird condemning NBA racial justice demonstrations. But the quote was made up. Maine politics is not immune from these tactics. A viral tweet made the rounds quoting Senator Susan Collins and Donald Trump, and that isn't real either. Steve Missler, this tweet was shared 8,000 times. What's going on?
Yeah, that tweet you're referring to, Erwin, was from a Twitter user, and I'm not even sure if it's a real person, frankly, who linked to a month-old story that doesn't even contain the fabricated quote in the tweet. And that fabricated quote was, yes, I said that I wouldn't endorse him, but that doesn't mean I don't fully support him. That's, of course, supposedly Collins talking about Trump, but it's not real. The tweet, like a lot of this stuff, is designed to play off people's frustration with Collins as it relates to the president. Again, she won't say if she's endorsing him, and we all know the reason why she's walking this very fine line. That's because she's trying not to alienate Trump supporters and not further angering voters who would like to see her hold the president accountable for his conduct. But there are a lot of people who find this balancing act maddening. And this tweet was designed to provoke a reaction from those people. And they got it. This thing, again, as you mentioned, shared 8,000 times. And you know, even after it was pointed out that it was completely made up, you could watch the rationalization in real time from those people who had actually shared it. It was basically like, well, it sounds like something Collins would say. I mean, it's just not good enough, right? I mean, it speaks to the power and pervasiveness of this stuff, which is really just designed to play off our biases. It's rage bait. And I think we'd all be better off if people would stop falling for it, because all it does is encourage more of it. And even just before we were getting ready to tape this segment, there was an example that came out from an anonymous account claiming to be the Skowhegan GOP, which doesn't exist. And it purported to show Dale Crafts, who's running in the 2nd Congressional District, vowing on Tucker Carlson's show to drive this monstrous snowplow down to Portland for the next Black Lives Matter demonstration. It's completely false. It's not going to happen. It wasn't even in the segment. You know, this stuff is everywhere. And again, it's pervasive and it plays off our biases, and we've got to be very vigilant about it.
And Steve, one thing that really is concerning about this is that tweet and post could have originated in the Kremlin. We had a report that came out this week from ABC News where they have found that the Department of Homeland Security was suppressing a report that said that one of the group of websites managed by the Russians to try to influence this year's elections had the same sort of outrageous claims that Joe Biden had mental health problems. And they did it very, very ingeniously. They created this website that looked like a legitimate news site. They even went so far as to recruit reporters in different countries to contribute to increase their legitimacy. You have to be real careful looking at a lot of this stuff that's out on the internet, because it is not based in a real news organization or a legitimate political organization. It's some group trying to influence the election improperly and illegally.
As this social media misinformation gains more attention, is it changing Maine politics? And if so, how?
I think it has to change Maine politics to a certain extent. And one of the things we have to do as members of the media is point out, as Steve just did, this particular bogus one. There are going to be more. There are going to be more outrageous ones. Senator King uses the analogy of what happened in Lithuania, where the Lithuanian government went out and very clearly pointed out the Russians are trying to influence our election. Beware of that. And the voters were very careful then. That's what we've got to do here.
Yeah, I would just add to what Mal is saying about the media's role in trying to check this stuff. I would just say that it is hard to do it too. Even last winter, a pretty innocuous meme was being shared by a state legislator. The legislator was basically, you know, trying to illustrate how wussified young people are these days, in his view. And the black and white photo showed a soldier holding a gun, reportedly at Normandy Beach. And it was juxtaposed with some stock art of what apparently passes for the stereotype of a young man in 2020, you know, skinny jeans, long hair, and weeping. But the problem was that the soldier in the photo was clearly from the Soviet Army. You know, it was clear on the uniform. He was even holding a Soviet machine gun. But that meme right now, to this day, I checked before we recorded, remains posted on that legislator's Facebook page, even after commenters pointed out that the meme likely originated from a Russian source. So even fact-checking these things isn't a remedy when confronted with this very powerful human impulse of rationalization.
Speaking of Russia, of course, it aimed to influence our election in 2016, and we're already hearing that it's happening again this year. Both Maine Senators Angus King and Susan Collins sit on the Senate Intelligence Committee, which has been investigating the matter. Steve, what is King saying about this issue?
Well, we know he's quite upset about the National Intelligence Director, John Ratcliffe, announcing that he won't be providing in-person briefings about election security matters to the Intelligence Committee. And King was all over last week's news programs blasting this decision, saying that it can't be explained or allowed. And Democrats are obviously furious about it, too, because they believe Ratcliffe is doing this at the behest of the president, who we all know doesn't like to hear or the public to hear that Russians are trying to help him get elected again. King, I think, called it a pre-cover-up during an interview with CNN. Now, the administration says withholding these in-person briefings is designed to prevent media leaks or partisan grandstanding during intelligence briefings. But I think most people who watch the Senate Intelligence Committee in particular know that they're not nearly as partisan as most other committees. And that's not true of the House Intelligence Committee, which is frankly a complete disaster. But the Senate committee is much better about these things. I mean, this is the same committee that signed off on a unanimous report about Russia's influence in the 2016 election. And it was a very comprehensive report. Some might say even more comprehensive than what Robert Mueller produced in his special prosecutor investigation of the president. This is not going to go away, and I don't know if anything that Congress can do to make these briefings become in person again, but if you look at recent history and these conflicts between Congress and the executive branch, not much ever really gets resolved. It goes to court, and it just sort of goes there, and there's no resolving it.
Yeah. Mal, what about the Senator Collins? What has she been saying?
Well, pretty much the same as Senator King, outraged that the Director of National Intelligence would stop those briefings, and rejecting the notion that the committee somehow was the source of these national security leaks that the president was citing and that Ratcliffe was citing. What struck me was within minutes of King's statement coming out on the wire, blasting this, we had one from Collins blasting the administration for doing this. This is an issue, and I saw several other Republican senators, Marco Rubio and others, come out within, you know, hours also denouncing this. And Senator King told me when the committee meets again, when they're back in Washington, there's going to be a pretty harsh discussion about how to make sure the Director of National Intelligence follows what he said he would do when he was confirmed, and that is report in person to the Intelligence Committee so they can ask questions.
Well, if you're a voter looking to cut through the fog of misinformation, you might want to watch candidate debates. This year, though, like many years, the debate schedule is being used by the candidates as a political weapon. Steve, what are we seeing in the Senate race here?
Well, what we're seeing is basically the inverse of what we typically see about debates. Usually, it's challengers are the ones calling for debates, not the incumbents. Why? Because challengers are usually trying to gain momentum and elevate their profile. And a great example of that was in 2014, when Democrat Shenna Bellows came out in July of that year and challenged Susan Collins to 10 debates. The response from Collins' campaign was like, yeah, we'll see in the fall. But that's not what's happening this year. This year, Collins challenged Democratic challenger Sarah Gideon to 16 debates. And she did it the day after Gideon won her Democratic primary. In fact, she wanted Gideon to debate that night of her issuing the challenge, which of course causes all kinds of logistical questions. But last week, Collins doubled down on her debate challenge when she and Gideon were campaigning in Caribou. Of course, you know, they never met for a debate or anything. But what's going on here, perhaps, is that these challenges seem to be a tactic by other Republican senators in tough reelection contests. This week, three Republicans, Arizona's Senator Martha McSally, Colorado Senator Cory Gardner, and North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis, issued a joint statement challenging their respective Democratic challengers to debates. Now, woven throughout these challenges is a narrative advanced by Republican incumbents and aligned interest groups that Democratic candidates are essentially empty vessels for Minority Leader Chuck Schumer's tax-raising, job-killing agenda, that each of them are hiding in a quote-unquote windowless basement awaiting orders. Just Google windowless basement and Democrats and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. But it's also possible that this effort to portray Democratic Senate candidates as Schumer's foot soldiers has some synergy with Trump's claims that Biden is a Trojan horse for liberal radicals. I mean, the messaging cohesion with the top of the ticket is also similar on the Democratic side. Each of the Democratic challengers in the Senate races that we just mentioned, including Gideon, are running as moderate unifiers, not partisan warriors, just like their presidential nominee, Joe Biden.
The reality is, with the incumbents, in this case, we're talking to the Republican incumbents, feel they're probably in better shape to answer questions than their challengers, because in many cases, they have lived the issue, so to speak, through multiple public hearings and floor debates, and have honed their positions. And I think what Collins is saying is, she wants a debate with Gideon to show that she is the one who's best suited to represent the state because she has the knowledge of the state, the knowledge of the issues, et cetera.
Well, elections sometimes have the power to influence other elections, something we've discussed before here on The Pulse. And new research say that may be increasing, affecting a characteristic that Maine voters have displayed for years, namely the split ticket. Now, what is the Pew Research Center saying about that?
The Pew data is wonderful. I read every one that comes out, but it's national data. If you look at what's going on here in Maine, we still have an awful lot of ticket splitters. For example, we wouldn't have a Democratic representative, Jared Golden, in the second district if there weren't Republicans who voted for him and for Trump. And that shows up when you look at the actual numbers of the ballots and the exit polls. So we're still a state that has considerable amount of split ticket where people go in and they say, candidate X, I think is going to do the better job. I don't care if it's an R or a D. We still have more folks who are unenrolled than enrolled in either one of the major parties. And I think that's is kind of indicative of the splitting of the ticket because they tend to go in and say, who's the best person for the job? And they vote that way. That's not to say that there aren't Republicans that do that and Democrats that do that, or else you would end up with some very different results over the past elections here in Maine.
Steve, that research looked particularly at Senate campaigns. What might it indicate about the other elections here or other ballot issues in Maine?
As it related to Senate campaigns, the research essentially said that there's been a trend over the last, 10, 15 years where Senate races are largely being determined by the most recent winner of the presidential election. So if a state votes for a Democratic presidential candidate, for example, there's a good chance that the Senate choice will reflect that same preference. But hard to know really how it'll affect other races or if that trend, as Mal points out, is it getting down ballot. I mean, Maine is not immune from national trends. It may be behind on this particular one, but if it continues, you could certainly, envision a day where you could see less ticket splitting, even in legislative races, which have historically been influenced by personal relationships, frankly, or a person standing in their respective community. You know, a Democrat might vote for John Jones, even if he's a Republican, because he knows he's a good business person and he happens to like him personally. There's countless examples of that happening all across the state. I don't know if we'll see it get down that far, but I've certainly seen a change just in the type of politics we see in the state legislature, where there's certainly more partisan. There's less coming together. There's more budget battles, and you know, especially in the recent years than we've seen than when I first started covering the State House 10 years ago. Partisan divide is also, I think, a symptom of the fact that national groups are increasingly trying to influence legislative contests, not just in Maine, but all over the country. Because of the deadlock in Congress, national interest groups are trying to get a foothold in state legislatures. And when they do that, they dump a ton of money into state legislative races to try to control the balance of power in one of the two chambers or both. You know, as that happens, you can see polarization or more partisanship happening even in the legislature, even in a citizen legislature like Maine's.
All right, well, that's Maine's Political Pulse for this week. We update the podcast each Friday afternoon. Most of it airs on Weekend Edition Sunday, and a shorter excerpt can be heard on Morning Edition Mondays. A reminder to check out Steve Missler's Maine Political Pulse newsletter. You can find that online at our website, mainepublic.org. Willis Ryder Arnold produces the Pulse podcast. Music is by Rob Holt. I'm Erwin Gratz. Thanks for listening.